Hello, and welcome to the Inns of Court College of Advocacy podcast. I'm Patrick Ryan. We're recording this conversation in the run-up to International Women's Day on the 8th of March, and I'm delighted to be joined by Her Honour Judge Suzanne Goddard, QC. Judge Goddard was called to the bar in 1986 and became a member of Lincoln House Chambers. She was appointed a recorder in 2002 and took silk in 2008. Since 2015, she's been a circuit judge and she sits at Crown Square in Manchester. Suzanne, thank you for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. Can we start with a little history? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in North Wales called Llangollen, close to the Welsh borders, near Wrexham and Chester. So I went to the local school till I was 16, and then I went away for a couple of years to do my A-levels.
And who or what inspired your interest in the law?
My family were not lawyers. My father was a mining engineer, my mother was a nurse, so we didn't have legal connections. I'm afraid to say that it was about watching television. I used to watch a television programme called Paper Chase, which was about a very eminent Harvard law professor and his students. And they would have wonderful discourses on the law and discussions and solve mysteries along the way. And that stimulated my interest in studying law. About the same time, there was a television series called Rumpole of the Bailey, which was written by a very eminent barrister from London called John Mortimer. That, again, made me think being a barrister sounds like a really interesting and fun profession.
And so what was the journey once that had piqued your interest? How did you go about getting into the profession?
I have to say my school really didn't have a clue. They didn't even know that you didn't have to study a law degree to go into the law. But nevertheless, I wanted to study law, so that didn't matter. My family were very supportive. My father was very interested in helping me. And so I did a mini pupillage with a barrister in Chester called Martin Thomas, Queen's Counsel, now a law lord, a liberal law lord. And I went along with him to court just to see what it was actually like in reality. I can still remember now, it was a rape case. And it fascinated me, and I thought that I had the confidence and the ability to have a career at the bar. And so when I was at university, that was what I had always set my heart on. I have to say, it wasn't particularly encouraged at Manchester University in the early 80s. I don't think it was a case that because you're a woman, don't go to the bar. Yeah. It was a case that it's a very difficult profession to get a start in. You may be wasting your time. You'd have a much more solid career if you went to be a solicitor. But they did have a bar liaison officer, Hazel Carty. He was very encouraging. And I did some mini pupillages and off I went to London to bar school.
Having done, would have been bar finals in those days, I
imagine. It was bar finals.
Yes. Having done bar finals, where did you do pupillage?
I came back up to Manchester. I'd set my heart on doing a pupillage outside London, hopefully on the Northern Circuit. And I was lucky enough to get a pupillage offer at Lincoln House. Then it was Rational House Chambers. David Sumner was the head of chambers in those days. We were a small, newly formed set of chambers. I think there were 15 barristers when I joined. And when I left, I think there were 80. So during my time there, we saw the profession change hugely from mainly small sets of chambers into much larger entities. So a time of great change for the legal profession.
How do you reflect now on your experience in pupillage?
I'll have to be careful about this because my pupil master is actually a judge with me here at Crown Square. I had a very enjoyable and informative pupillage, but it wasn't in any way structured. I think he may have had to just fill out a form at the end of it to certify that I was competent, but that really was about it. I think nowadays it's much more structured, and I think that's a very good thing. To try and ensure that all pupils, whether they are with a sole practitioner or in a much larger set, are going to get the range of experiences that they need to start their professional life. I saw some great cases when I was with Alan Conrad. I was in front of some very interesting judges, and we also had a lot of fun. The time I look back on very fondly now.
Thinking about the early part of your career and building a practice, were there challenges that you think that you faced that your male contemporaries did not?
I think when I started out in practice, it was still quite unusual to see a female criminal barrister. It was much more usual to see female barristers in the family law, some civil law practices as well. So, yes, I think it was more challenging to be a woman. I very rarely saw overt chauvinism. But occasionally you'd turn up and a client would say, I'm not having a woman represent me. and you would try and talk them round because that's your job. But they were very, very much in the minority because people are generally very respectful of the fact that you have the qualification and that you are there as a barrister. And if they don't want to be represented by a woman, well, they tell the solicitor beforehand and you never get the brief in the first place.
What are your fondest memories of life at the bar?
Certainly at the junior bar, it was the camaraderie of being with my contemporaries and colleagues. You were travelling around to different courts every day of the week, all over the Northwest, having different experiences every day. There was always someone that you could go to ask for help and advice. That's the wonderful thing about the chamber system. Rational House Chambers was incredibly friendly. We had a good social life outside of work. And somehow, I don't think it was as stressful as it seems to be now, whether that's because everybody's commuting life has got more difficult, it's more difficult to travel to places, different courts, there's more law involved than there ever was.
Right?
So, yes, I think probably life is more difficult for junior practitioners now than it was for us. I was also very lucky in that when I came to the bar in 86, some of the legal aid changes had just come into effect. So there was universal legal aid. For the first time, I think there were standardised legal fees on legal aid. So you knew you were going to get paid. There was a lot of legal aid work around and less barristers to do it. So if you were in a reasonable set of chambers, it didn't take long for you to build up a sufficient income to be able to live off, which was obviously in contrast to what had happened in the 60s and 70s.
You took Silk in 2008.
I did.
What prompted your decision?
It was a difficult decision to take Silk. I was very much encouraged by some of my senior colleagues, particularly Alistair Webster, who felt that it was time that I stepped forward. I had concerns because you never know whether you're going to succeed in building a practice in Silk or not. It is a big step to go onto the front row because I'd done a lot of work as junior sitting behind leaders. And I very much enjoyed that work. I enjoyed being part of a team and preparing the cases and doing some of the advocacy. But once you take Silk, you are the person who is taking all of the big decisions. And that brings with it its own stress. But obviously, it's a wonderful position within the profession to be in. And I was delighted when I succeeded on my first application.
What were the major changes you noticed moving from the junior bar into Silk?
Becoming a Silk, you are entering an even more competitive world than the junior bar because obviously there is less and less work for criminal Silks to do. The rules have been tightened up. Silk certificates are less readily granted by the Crown Court. The Crown Prosecution Service are less willing to engage QCs to prosecute their cases. And so it is incredibly competitive. I always felt people were standing over me, wanting to know what was in my diary, what I was doing. You've got to have broad shoulders. You've got to be tough. When they say, ask you in the interview, are you resilient? You need to be resilient. I thought when I took Silk, well, maybe it will give me more time to prepare cases because I won't be in court all the time. I'll be able to manage my practice. It doesn't work like that. You find that you're suddenly instructed in a multi-handed murder case that's starting in 2 weeks' time. There is no way the judge is going to take the case out, so you can have more time to read it. So you are just going to have to sit up till 2 o'clock in the morning and get up at five and ensure that it is prepared and everything is done. And so there's a lot more pressure in being in Silk than there is in being at the junior bar, I think.
As a criminal Silk and now as a judge, you will have seen and now you try very distressing cases or cases with very, very distressing elements to them. How do you avoid taking work home with you?
Mentally, taking work home, it is difficult. But after 30 years in the profession, you do have to build up resilience. But I think it is fantastic that the profession as a whole and the judiciary are taking on board the ideas of mental well-being. Because we're all susceptible to stress. I try and ensure that I get exercise, I get some fresh air, I try and make sure I walk to the tram a couple of times a week. Sometimes we go out on a judicial walk at lunchtime just to clear our heads and get a bit of exercise. I know that Judge Singleton, who's now taken over at the Civil Justice Centre, has started a yoga programme and a meditation programme for the judges, I think, and for the staff as well.
Yeah.
And we also, the staff here, have a wellbeing programme that the judges take part in. So sometimes you may deal with a very distressing case and it is something that will stay in your mind. There is now a helpline that you can call so that you can speak to someone and get some counselling if you are finding it difficult. You know, cases that involve horrendous rapes or child abuse can be very difficult. I think during the case, as a judge, you're so concerned with ensuring that you get to a just verdict, you're worried about the jury, making sure that the case is being properly conducted, that you can put your emotions to one side. It's when the case is finished that sometimes you find your mind turning back to what can be very distressing experiences when you've heard rape victims give evidence about these terrible things that have happened to them. So it's something you've got to keep an eye on.
Coming to your judicial career, is there anything you've learnt on the bench that you wish you'd known when you were still at the bar?
The main thing is patience. You need a great deal of patience to be a judge. You need to understand that an awful lot's going on outside your courtroom door, and you have to trust the bar and the advocates that they are doing their job properly and getting on with it. Whether having more patience would have particularly helped me as a barrister, probably not. But that's certainly the attribute that I am continually trying to improve upon.
And what was the biggest change you noticed in moving from the bar to the bench in your professional life or life generally?
Well, you get back your weekends a bit more if you're a judge, because the pattern of work is such that you're able to accommodate more during your working day, catching up with preparation. So it's good to have weekends when you can plan to go away. As you will recall, Patrick, you know, you have to cancel going out for dinner, going to the theatre, because the pressure of work is such at the bar that that has to take priority. So I think you do get a slightly better work-life balance when you're on the bench. Although, of course, if you're in a big case, you've got a summing up to prepare, then, yes, the old idea of weekend work comes back to the fore.
What challenges do you think remain for women coming into the profession and succeeding once they get there?
There is no doubt that women, along with people from ethnic minorities, are being encouraged to apply to the judiciary, and that is an excellent thing. There are more female judges now, and the graph keeps going upwards. The difficulty is when you get to the high levels of the profession, I don't think there are very much increasing numbers of women applying for the High Court bench and the Supreme Court. I think the difficulty is it's still very difficult to carry on having such high-powered jobs alongside running a family. Yeah. It's not an easy career choice to take, particularly if you have a very successful junior practice in areas like commercial law, civil law, where people's incomes are so much higher. But I think it's a very rewarding side of the profession to go into, and people are still interested in shaping the law and making a big contribution to society.
Is there anything in your mind that could be done that isn't being done to improve access to the profession?
There is a push to get judges to go out into the community, to go out in schools, to engage more with the public, to explain what we do. We do have a new programme at Crown Square involving a local school in the city centre in Manchester, where I think we have three candidates who were selected to be mentored through the Crown Court over a period of years in their sixth form, so that they get to engage with the profession, get to engage with the judiciary, and perhaps have some encouragement that they too could be a lawyer, could be a solicitor or an advocate or a barrister and one day be a judge. So it's those sorts of programmes that are widening people's ideas so that they think, well, yes, they too could take on a job like this. And that is even though Rumpole the Bailey is no longer showing on the television. So, yes, it's all about making people aware, making people have the ambition to think, yes, I could do this.
If you could change one thing about the profession or the law, for that matter, what would it be?
I would try and get people to be on time in court.
The patience thing's going well.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's not always possible, is it?
Other than being on time in your court, what are the most valuable attributes for an advocate for a junior advocate particularly, to foster and to cultivate?
It's always preparation, isn't it? Preparation, brevity and confidence. If you have all of those three things and you put them into practice, then you will succeed in the law.
And if you had your time ever again, would you still come into the law?
I would very much still come into the law. I think it is more challenging now. I think the fact that students have to pay their university fees, which I didn't have to, is a significant burden when you start out in your professional life. But you're going to have that, whatever career you go into now, you have to pay for your degree course. But that extra investment to take your bar final qualifications, building up a practice during pupillage, the rewards of being an advocate, being a barrister, are immense. You are able to change people's lives. You are able to play a vital part in the administration of justice in this country. Your life will not be boring. It's a fantastic profession, and we need to attract the best people from the broadest possible backgrounds.
And with that in mind, what's the best piece of advice you've been given that you'd pass on to other people?
Apart from always be on time.
Apart from being on time in your court, yeah.
The best piece of advice always has to be as prepared as you can. Whether that's for an interview or to go into court or go into a meeting, always do your preparation.
And finally, what are you proudest of?
What am I proudest of? One case absolutely stands out in my mind, in my career. It was representing a woman who had been a drug addict for many, many years. She had two children. She was on benefits. She obviously had no money. She had an enormous amount of fines that had built up, I think about £2,000. And she was appealing that sentence to the Crown Court. And I came along to represent her, and I came up in front of someone who I thought was a very tough judge, Judge Blackburn, Queen's Counsel, I think he was. He sat in these courts for many, many years. He never let you know what he was thinking, and he had a pretty tough reputation. And I prepared the case thoroughly. I tried to find some authorities that might persuade him that this was wholly inappropriate. And much to my surprise, at the end of the hearing, he did absolutely wipe the slate clean. So she walked out of court with a conditional discharge and the chance to start her life again. And the next day in chambers, I got a card from her, which thanked me for what I'd done for her. And I just thought, for a woman like that to go into the card shop and spend 50p or a pound sending me a card meant a huge amount to me. And yeah, I was very proud of that.
Suzanne, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Patrick.